Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Critical Moves. On today's episode, I, your host Jack, am joined by Adam.
Hello, everyone.
And a very special guest, Mr. Thomas Vandenberg.
Hi, everybody. I'm Thomas.
Thomas, I should have asked you this before we started recording, but did I pronounce that correctly?
You pronounced that absolutely perfectly.
Okay, thank you. I've been worried about that. Thomas here, for anyone who is unaware, is the creator and kind of original pioneer behind the game Kingdom, now known as Kingdom Classic, and the, I guess, finalized and updated version, Kingdom New Lands.
Yeah.
So, Thomas, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Yeah, how are you?
I'm well. And Adam?
I'm fine. I'm looking forward to this interview, to be honest, because I have some memories with the game, so I will mention them.
Nice.
Yeah, so when we originally thought about doing this episode, Thomas, we brought it up at the end of another episode. We were just chatting amongst ourselves. And for a long time now, before that conversation, I've actually been dead set on wanting to do this interview with you.
So cool.
Because whenever we're on the podcast and we're talking about strategy games, there are tons of people that we could try to interview and games we could talk about. But the main thing to me is, there are games that resonate more with me because I've spent a good bit of time on Kingdom, more so Kingdom 2 Crowns, but we'll get into that just because of like accessibility or discoverability. And more than anything, I wanted to, like I emailed you about before, expand the narrative of what we could talk about. Because Kingdom is like it's built as a micro strategy game.
Absolutely. It's built as a minimal puzzles strategy game or something like that.
And so this interview is like a huge deal for me, and Adam was excited for it because when I brought it up at the time, Adam was like, oh, I played tons of Kingdom in college, right?
Yep, tons of it. It was me, because in Poland college, we need to go to lectures. It's obligatory. So this was the game that allowed me to cope with the lecture and not to sleep during them. So playing on my iPhone. So that's why I had such a huge amount of memories about the game.
I love that you played it on the phone, actually, because nowadays I kind of think about mobile as being kind of lost to deep premium games. But back then, also I really enjoyed making the game for iPhone as well. Like, it has a different control scheme, and I really felt like the very crispy pixel art fits well on the small screen too. It's fun that you played it on that.
Yeah, and you mentioned control scheme. It was perfect for a mobile game because I tried playing some mobile games, mobile strategy games, and they were, you know, when you have your big thumb, and I had iPhone 6S back then when I played it. Like, I couldn't basically press anything because I couldn't aim anything. And your game, you know, you can play with one finger, and still it was really exciting to play even like that. So
yeah, that's fun that you say that because I've been thinking a lot about control schemes for strategy games. Like, I love strategy games. It's one of the things I grew up on. I had a PC from when I was quite young, and the first games I played were strategy games as well. But I've kind of outgrown the PC gaming a little bit. I guess partially because I spent 10 hours a day at the PC with a mouse and a keyboard. And then I want to sit down on the couch. But it's hard for strategy games. And of course, Kingdom is in a way a strategy game that you can control in a very, you know, in a different way. It doesn't require a mouse.
Yeah. And even nowadays, like, because back then there wasn't like a gamepad compatibility on iPhone, I guess. And right now it is, but it's still kind of lackluster. And on the other hand, we didn't have such a huge market of microtransaction games. I don't know, like, mobile gaming today is in a strange place.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to go back to a time where we really think about premium experiences, and by that I mean like making a game that's a beautiful compact experience and not trying to milk you for microtransactions on phones, but it's not like, it doesn't seem likely at the moment.
Yeah, when I look at because I prepared for this interview and I looked at the Wikipedia, I noticed that you had some inspirations by Infinity Blade. And this was the huge mobile game back at the times. I don't know if you remember it.
True. Wait, what? I definitely remember it because it was an Unreal game that runs on a phone, right?
Yes, and you see, we talked with Jack about it. That probably maybe you won't remember about it, but on the Wikipedia it states that the narrative was inspired by Infinity Blade.
Wow, I wonder what the source is of that.
Yeah, it's funny. Adam just said we were talking about it like right before we got into the interview, and he was telling me about that point for his research, and I'm like, really, where did you find that? Because I'm looking at the images of Infinity Blade because I'm unfamiliar, and I'm like, this looks nothing like Kingdom, and I'm not sure what he's referring to. He's like, well, that's what it says. It says it on Wikipedia, and so I'm like, well, if you bring it up and he doesn't know what you're talking about, you know, it'll be a good time. So
that is funny. Also, it's something now I'm going to do some research and see where that came from. It could be that it's one of the influences on, you know, I'm not the only one who's worked on Kingdom. There have been many people involved in the game, you know, from New Lands onwards, so there's probably a lot of inspirations in there.
So it occurred that we are right, Jack. That maybe it's
It is tangential to something I wanted to mention, because it's like, that was one of the games that exemplified, like, look what your phone can do, like what a powerful computer it is. And now they are hundreds of times faster than they were back then. And yet I feel like we're doing less with them. You know, back then it was kind of this like ideal of like, oh, wow, you can just run Unreal games and they're going to look so sick on your phone. And now all everybody plays is like 2D match 3 games on phones that are so much more powerful. It's a bit of a shame. I guess it's also European or American market. I'm assuming in Asia they play a lot more like real games on mobile. But, you know, what do I know?
Yeah, when I'm playing on consoles, sometimes on PlayStation, they're marketing this Asian games. They're like slice service mobile ports or something like that. Like, yeah. I'm not playing the Genshin Impact, I guess, is the biggest example of that. And I tried to play that. Unfortunately, I don't know, maybe I'm too old for that, or I don't know.
That's so fun. Honestly, I feel like Genshin Impact is one of the things that makes me feel like I'm out of touch. Like, I was at Gamescom in Cologne this year. I was showing Garbage Country, my new game there. And I ventured outside of the indie area for like one round across the AAA halls, you know, and then there's the one hall where there's Genshin Impact, and it's so big and there's so many players. And I have like, I don't even know what that game is. And I feel like I'm so out of touch with like gaming sometimes.
This was my first experience when there was like a genre called, like, there was a genre, and it was, and it's called gacha games. And I was like, what the hell is gacha games? And I looked online, and until this day, I'm not quite understanding what it basically means. It's like looter stuff, crazy, looting stuff, but yeah, it's crazy.
Gaming goes so deep.
Yeah, on the other hand, like, lots of my friends play it. So I couldn't do, like, I tried, and one of my friends told me, Adam, you shouldn't try too hard because you will stay in playing it and it's not a good game. That's what he told me. So I don't know. That's the only thing I heard.
Yeah.
I actually think that's a nice point for transition, because we're about almost 10 minutes into this, and I want to go ahead and like describe for anybody who doesn't know what Kingdom is, because it's not all we're going to talk about today from Thomas's work, but for anyone who doesn't know what Kingdom is, Kingdom is a 2D side-scrolling economy resource management strategy game. And the game itself is billed as a micro-strategy game. And the core premise is essentially that you exist as the player character on horseback, and you're able to travel left and right across the island that you inhabit at any given time. And you're able to control workers that you hire. And the entire bulk gameplay loop of the game is generally handled through a core resource of gold coins that you invest and receive from having played the core gameplay loop. And so for anybody listening, that just means that it's a very simple control scheme. You're able to essentially travel left and right, and then you also have a button dedicated to dropping coins or essentially placing coins into a visible slot. And obviously different things take different amounts. The economy is balanced in that way. You're able to invest coins and make more back from your investments. But the core gameplay loop and the overall mechanics that get introduced across your time in the game are pretty simple, But it does a good job of expanding the core premise as you progress through the game and the islands that you can inhabit. Of course, also there's the threat that every single night there is the creeps, as I think Thomas referred to them in an older interview, coming out, which I think now they're called the Greed, but Thomas referred to them as the creepy guys that come out at night and attack the walls of your castle or village and attempt to kill your workers and steal their jobs. So that's the core premise. I bring all that up because, as a good transition, we're talking about gacha games, we're talking about how deep gaming runs, and I think, Thomas, you might not want to accept this, or maybe you would disagree with me on this, but I think Kingdom really pioneered an area of genre mashing, right? Because you've talked a lot about like the feedback you've gotten or the experience of making something that's like a 2D side-scrolling strategy game where it's like, it's mostly resource management. People think it's a platformer, but it's really like a very minimalist strategy game. And I think that genre of mashing has worked so well because there's plenty of games that come out now that try to replicate what Kingdom has done. And when I look at them, I think of Kingdom. It's like inescapable no matter what style they try to choose, no matter what additions they try to make, how much more the complex they make it. It looks like a Kingdom clone.
Especially if it's got the water reflections in front of them. But it's interesting what you say, that I guess because Kingdom is so minimal, it's an easy reference point for a lot of things to be like it. And a lot of other games kind of expand in a lot of different directions. You know, they are platformers, for example, because one of the early feedback that I always got from players is like, why can't I like hack with my sword? Like, why can't I attack as a character? And there's this desire for people to make it into more of a platformer game. And I think those other games do that. And maybe Kingdom's minimalism just makes it kind of like a reference point for those kind of games that have a little bit of strategy. And the other thing you said that I thought was interesting. Well, yeah, it's minimalist on the surface. I always think if you grab a game, it should be immediately clear how you're going to control it. And you shouldn't be overwhelmed by like, oh, these are all the choices. Those choices should kind of like sneak up on you as you play the game. So as you're kind of like discovering what you're doing. And I think also that's an aspect in which Kingdom is minimal, which other games, of course, it's tempting to expand. Like the game that I'm working on now falls victim to that. Like it's a much bigger game with more options, more things to do, more UI, etc. And in Kingdom, somehow, miraculously, we always resisted going that route. And that kept it just really like kind of conceptually very pure and very easy to think of like, oh yeah, that's Kingdom, because it's like you can only do three things. You can walk left, right, and throw a coin.
And I think the beauty of that for Kingdom is that it falls into like, it's not necessarily a real genre, but it's something I would refer to as like aesthetic strategy, right? Because you, when you play the game, like you said, it has to be accessible and minimalist to start with. One of the appeals of it to me is that it opens up a little bit more. And while they've added a lot of things in Kingdom Two Crowns to kind of really expand that, I was actually surprised based on my experience when I went back and played Kingdom New Lands for the first time for this, that certain things that I expected to happen at a certain point happened faster, and it made me understand what they must have done to I guess lengthen out the gameplay. But that said, it falls into like aesthetic strategy because you're collecting coins, you're spending the resources, but the appeal is like the atmosphere and how accessible the gameplay really is, like what you're talking about. And so I think that's something that so many strategy games are trying to replicate more than just steal a gameplay loop that you've come up with or philosophy. It's like trying to replicate the aesthetic of MicroStrategy.
That's interesting. Like, what would that definition? Because I love this term, like aesthetic strategy, because for me, the aesthetics or the vibes or the atmosphere have always been a part of strategy games, of why I love them. Like, I remember the Warcraft 3 single player campaigns that are the early levels in the campaign. They are so pretty. Like you're walking through these like half submerged forests and stuff. Like it's really about the vibes and the aesthetics of those places as well. And that's something I kind of sought to replicate. I also like kind of every strategy game I remember, I also really remember the way it looks and feels, and Kingdom is kind of all about that. And I think that is something that you maybe don't experience as actively when you play the game, and then you can come away with it thinking like, oh yeah, if we build a game that does, you know, is a minimal strategy game, it will be the same in some ways. But the more mechanics you put in it, the less space you're leaving for the aesthetics, maybe. But I think also, if you've probably played a game called Thronefall that was released recently, I feel like that's kind of like taking some of Kingdom's mechanics and like the very pure mechanics of Kingdom, but not chasing the aesthetic aspect of it so much, and also being very successful. So that's also kind of interesting.
Yeah, I haven't played Thronefall personally. I remember, if it's what I'm thinking of, and I'll check in a moment, I remember it being everywhere on Reddit. It was like it was constantly advertised to me on Reddit as like the actual sponsored ads. And I saw it and I'm like, that looks just like Kingdom. And anyways, it was intriguing to me because I knew they were just going to like take the gameplay loop and make it so much bigger. And it's still interesting to me. That's not to like harp on them for what they're trying to do, because that's how games are made. But
no, I think it's much tighter also. I think Kingdom has to compromise a lot because of aesthetic reasons. For example, I wanted the forests to feel like a certain size, you know, like you should be in this lush forest island. But that means that the enemies are just going to take a minimum amount of time to reach your walls, which is kind of really annoying, because every day and night lasts like 5 minutes. If the enemy spent 2 minutes walking to your walls, that really limits the kind of mechanics you could implement in the game. That kind of really messes with any kind of tight gameplay loop. So once you let go of those aesthetic constraints, like, you know, maybe the forest doesn't have to be so big, you can make a much tighter game also.
Okay, so it opens up so much because, you know, I'm so excited, I want to talk about everything, but like what you're talking about now makes me want to jump right into like what I think is the, for lack of a better term, like the genius of the design philosophy there, which is obviously intentional, but it's like, it's one of those things you don't think about, where what makes Kingdom work so well in the 2D art style is that, like you said, as the player, you have to compromise as a strategy game, where you start off around the middle of the island, I suppose. And as you expand, it's like you said, so that the time of the day is around like 5 minutes for the day and the night, which means that the closer you stick to the middle of the island and don't expand, the longer it takes the greed to reach you, which means that they have less time to potentially break in or anything anyways. But as a core feature of the game, you also have to expand to be able to continue to keep up with the increasingly difficult waves of greed across different nights, or like I suppose they're blood moons, I'm not sure, whatever they'd be referred to on the Wikipedia, but like the moons that come out every once in a while and affect the strength. But that's what makes it so interesting to me, is like you have to expand in order to be able to like continue to even grow and progress through the game, but doing so makes it more accessible for the greed to reach you on the island, but at the same time it gives you more walls. So it's like, it's things like that, and it's also the design philosophy, everything built around the idea of just managing at least the gold coins and how that works into interacting with everything. There really is like no other form of interaction in the game besides just investing the money, and that has always stuck with me so much.
Yeah, it's been hard to stick with that, like, you know, in a strategy game, one of the things that comes to mind very early is like, oh, you want to choose which building goes where, which of course doesn't work if you're only putting coins in the ground. You get one building that is predestined to be in that location. So, you know, you're also kind of losing out on a lot of potential depth. And I think some games that are similar to Kingdom have gone that way, where you can choose which building to put where. And, you know, some are successful in actually opening up the strategic space. But you're kind of constantly like fighting those constraints. And I remember that a lot of the time our policy there, our philosophy was, instead of like, if there's a bit of friction in the design and it doesn't seem to quite work out, instead of like overhauling everything and fixing it, I would just kind of like try to mitigate it by like tweaking the numbers. Like if the greed are taking too long to reach the walls, okay, I would just make them a little bit faster until it kind of almost works. But we never like overhauled the core design to kind of satisfy those constraints, which in the end has worked out. There is a lot of friction and there are things that are just inelegant, but it's also allowed the game to stay relatively pure in a way.
Absolutely. And if I ever had to justify, like if listeners of this are looking up the game and this is their first impression of Kingdom and they're wondering like the justification for strategy, having played and put some hours into Kingdom, whenever I started up this new save of Kingdom New Lands, as somebody with experience, I knew like, okay, I need to skip this mound of dirt and then build a wall on this one. And I was actually strategizing, anticipating knowing like what buildings I'll unlock, because one of the things that always stuck with me my first time playing was the self-exploration that you intended on, of playing through the game and then realizing like, oh, I'll push the walls further and then I'll place an archer tower on a rock. And then my wall has expanded 4 or 5 more times. And now I just have this archer wasted on a tower that I don't know, like maybe I'm crazy and you can take them out of there. But I've always thought you couldn't. So it felt like, okay, well, I've lost that archer, you know, need to find new people to recruit. And so to justify strategy, like absolutely, as somebody with hours in the game, starting up a new save, going into this game, I was 100% like, I need to only place walls in these spots and refuse to build any archer towers until I actually felt comfortable with leaving the island for the first time, things like that. So like, there's absolutely a level to understanding the game and that impacting the gameplay choices that you make on a second, third, fourth playthrough, or even just in the same run, obtaining a new island where you basically start over.
Yeah, combined with a little bit of procedural generation. So every map is slightly different. You'll find different things in different places that makes, you know, different strategies work better than others. I wonder if there is still an appetite for this kind of game currently. I feel like going back to my childhood, like you didn't understand games at all, right? There was no tutorial. You were just clicking things and hoping that you were like clicking the right thing to make the door open or whatever. And like, I feel even 10 years ago, maybe there was more like Kingdom hit a sweet spot of like where there was still people's willingness to kind of like find out things and like not understand things. I wonder if you could make Kingdom today with the same level of it being unclear what's going to work or what the consequences of your actions are, or if players nowadays just don't have that patience or desire to be kind of confused like that. On the other hand, maybe because they're communicating much more in communities like Discord, maybe there's more appetite. Maybe they just ask each other, like, how did you solve it? Did you put archers on this wall? Like, it's an interesting point. At least me, I'm noticing in the games that I'm currently building, I am preempting it much more. Like, I'm trying to tell the player much more, like, what's going to happen, or at least being clear what are the outcomes going to be of your actions. And that was always, Kingdom doesn't do a lot of that.
Yeah, basically, what I believe, it also comes down to the times that your game was created, because I read that you first created a prototype in Flash, am I right?
Yeah.
And I'm old enough to play Flash games, again, Jack. because Jack is the, you know, 13-year-old of our team, so he hasn't played probably Flash games. But no, of course, I'm joking. And like 50% of these games... what I remember is that basically you didn't have a clue what is happening. Basically, you started the game, I pressed start, I haven't read the instructions, I always skipped them and just played what happened. And the point that I'm like trying to reach is that Flash games were really easy to reach. Like if you had Google Home, it had Flash installed, so you can almost open any site with games and have like 1,000 of them and you can skip through them. Like today, like I don't know if there is a place like that, to be honest, that has... I know there's like itch.io, for example, and so on, but still you need to make an effort to play these games. And the Flash games were the games that you can, you know, click even by accident and play some game, or like get a link and just start it in like a matter of seconds. So maybe that also changed. Like nowadays, okay, it's much easier for us gamers to reach for the indie games. On the other hand, you still need to download them, install them on the PC. Maybe they work, maybe not. And back in the days, Flash games, you know, were the pinnacle of accessibility, to be honest, in terms of what you can play.
Yeah, that's really true. I really grew up in the Flash days. I started programming in Flash in ActionScript. I made my first games in Flash and then Kingdom also. And it was very accessible, both for developers and for players. If you think about it, like downloading and playing a game on itch.io with the launcher is not that much harder than going on Newgrounds and playing a game. But these 3 extra mouse clicks are like all the difference. Yeah. Like you said, if a friend sends you a link and you go straight to the website and you're already playing it, then you'll play it. Whereas on itch, you have to download it, you have to click start. Like those 3 steps are huge. And also the developer community, I feel like there was a lot of support in Flash. Also, there was always the idea that like Flash games are kind of like free. Maybe you try to make some money with ads, but the fact that there are ads in there means that you actually want them to be distributed as widely as possible because you just get more ad income. So there was kind of this like, you know, games are just being shared, put on different websites. And also a lot of people were sharing like development help, like programming tips, I feel like in that sense, Flash was just very accessible. And yeah, cool. I do miss those days, even though now the tools are definitely better. You can just do so much cooler stuff. But the bar is also raised. Like, you have to do cooler stuff. Like, Kingdom the Flash game wouldn't make it nowadays.
To be honest, I don't miss Flash game's performance because it was really, really bad. Yeah, I see you laughing. You know what I mean right now. But yeah, it was horrible. Like, you really needed to have a good PC for them to play smoothly. But on the other hand, like, I don't know. For example, when I visited my aunt, I could boot up PC and just run a random game from the browser, and it worked. And that was crazy. Yeah. And I guess, like, we have browser games, but they are nowhere near accessible as Flash games were back then.
Yeah. And I also think that Flash, because it's not really a game engine necessarily, so you have to do everything yourself. So there was a lot of creativity in terms of game design. Like, it's not, like, if you start up Unreal Engine, you're automatically making a first-person shooter. Of course, you can make anything, but the base setup is it's a first-person shooter. And Flash has nothing, so you're kind of like building everything from the ground up. And I think that also led to a lot of creative games that were kind of built on Flash. And then there was, of course, the famous 2D physics engine, Box2D, that led to a lot of physics games like Angry Birds and whatnot, like this, you know, you're just knocking over some things, and the whole genre of knocking over things that came out of that. It was a creative explosion. But then again, nowadays we have 300 games per day launched on Steam. So for sure, there's also a lot of creativity there.
Yeah, but again, as you mentioned, they are on Steam. And this might be a little issue when it comes to the smallest of them. Like, you need to install Steam, you need to install the game. It needs to be on your hard drive. And this couple of steps make it much, maybe not much, but harder for people to reach a broader audience. Like, for example, you mentioned like Angry Birds. I remember, for example, Trials series. This was the series of motorbike driving through, like, from the left side to the right side. And this was a really simple game. And, you know, when we look, like, in the future, then we got amazing games like Door Danger series that was basically based on it. And or right now we have this game with this guy. I don't know, you probably know this game. The guy is in the bucket and he moves with a hammer. I don't know the name of this game.
Getting Over It.
Yeah, Getting Over It. And this is also a similar game, to be honest. Yes, you're like trying to make it to the end of the... Yeah. And it was started back in the Flash days.
And I guess there was a lot of Flash Tower Defense games as well that I used to play. There was, wasn't it called like Desktop Defense or something? I don't know. There was a lot of Tower Defense games in Flash as well.
Yeah, Tower Defense... I believe the tower defense genre was much wider back then. Like, right now, I try to look for new tower defense game on my Nintendo Switch, and to be honest, there are not a lot of them coming out, to be honest. So
that's interesting. That's another, like, if we're talking about, like, creative breeding grounds or whatever, the Warcraft 3 level editor was also such a place for creativity and such a great playground, because you have a game engine. And you have it set up with, like, if you start in Unity, there's no concept of a unit or an entity or a person or whatever. But Warcraft 3 just has little puppets, you know, little guys or girls with arms and weapon, whatever. And you can make rules. So you're much closer to, like, designing just the rules for the game rather than implementing, like, the technical parts of the game. You can just be like, no, this guy does so and so, and he defeats this other guy, and that's the rules of this game. And you can just think of kind of like almost board game like rules. And I just remember that Warcraft 3 custom maps were such a cool playground for all sorts of weird games. And a lot of them, like Tower Defense and you know, trace their roots. And there's current games that kind of like go back to that time.
Do you still remember like your favorite ones from Warcraft 3?
Definitely. I love the Tower Defense ones, especially the ones where you can build mazes. I always thought that was really fun. In my current game in Garbage Country, I'm also doing a tower defense where you can build mazes, even though I'm discovering it's so hard to balance, because if one person can make the maze twice as long, it's like the skill gap is just huge. So I understand why a lot of tower defense games don't do it, actually, but I really did like the ones where you could, because it just feels like creative, you know. You can, you're like, oh, I'm gonna make them walk all the way into this corner, and then they have to go around and come back, and I'm so good, I'm so smart. I also like the mini game ones. I always thought that was really fun. like there was one that was called Other Party, and you had to, like, every mini game was different, had different rules. There was, like, you had to hide from the werewolves, or you were to, I don't know, there's all sorts of different things, just kind of like this fun. And then the ones where you're like sending creeps, you know, you're kind of like, it's like an auto battler, you would call it these days, but basically you're just like buying creeps, but you're not controlling them, they're just walking and attacking the other creeps. It's like you're doing the lanes in Dota but without the heroes or something. Those I thought were really fun too. I think I am quite fascinated by, and it's the same in Kingdom, like you're controlling an army but not directly, you know, like you have these little soldiers doing stuff for you, but you're not like directly controlling them. It just, it's a nice feeling. It's like lemmings, there's like little guys doing stuff and you're just watching the effects of whatever you set in motion. And I think, you know, that's always just, I find that very entertaining.
Yeah, maybe your game was first auto battler, who knows? I don't know when it started, so maybe this was some point of the time. One other thing is that what I wanted to mention about your game design and how it plays is that when I was thinking about other games that are like that, like strategy games in platformer 2D style, it only came to me there was one game like that, and it was called Nom Nom Galaxy. I know if you heard about it. And like there were two games, Your Kingdoms, Nom Nom Galaxy, and there's nothing like that anymore. This is interesting.
I mean, a 2D strategy game, it's also, it's really annoying because the first decision you're making is like, can the troops overlap, you know, or can they be in the same location? And in Kingdom, obviously they can. But once you do that, it's kind of weird. Like, how do they fight? Do they all just hit everybody who's in the same location? Like, it's not a great premise, to be honest, for a real strategy game with depth. If everybody is just standing on the same point, like fighting each other. And if they don't stand in the same location, you have all sorts of other stuff to deal with. It's like, well, then they have to shoot from the back to hit anybody at all. And what happens to the poor guy in the front line? Is he just going to get hammered while the rest... Like, it's, I can see why, if you think about it, maybe you don't make this game. But once I was already locked in, I was like, you know, this can work. It looks fun, so...
Yeah, and what's more, it plays well using your fingers on and gamepads. Like, this is another issue of strategy games. You cannot play, like, making a control scheme for a strategy game is extremely hard, I believe. Like, there are examples I can count of my single hand that did it right. And your Kingdom was one of them, as I told you, played it during my lectures. So
Well, thank you. I think, have you ever played Tooth and Tail? I think that's a game, strategy game that was designed from the ground up to be gamepad compatible. It's top down, like it's not side scroller, but you control essentially a commander. I think that's kind of like the solution that you have. Also in games like, what's it called? The Nintendo Switch one, Pikmin, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're also controlling like a commander and the troops, you can either rally them to you or send them away. That's kind of like the limitation. And it's kind of, going back to Warcraft 3, because if you're building a strategy game in Unity, you have a lot of ground to cover. Like, I just did it for the tower defense, but it's like, wow, you're not getting a lot for free. Like, the concept of unit damage, modifiers, that's all not in there. Whereas in Warcraft 3, you had all of that stuff just for free. So you could start experimenting with different rules. So it's kind of a shame that we don't have that anymore, because that would allow people to experiment immediately with cool game rules. Like, how do you make a gamepad strategy game instead of first having to rebuild the entire groundwork of what is a strategy game?
Yeah, that's what we mentioned about Unreal Engine. That's exactly the point, yes. When you have Unreal Engine, you start with an FPS game.
Yeah, I think Unreal has slightly more of a concept of like damage and things in there, but yeah, you have to, you know, you're not getting a whole game engine for free that has little guys running around.
That's a similar case with Skyrim. Basically, this was also the same case. You got an RPG game, and then you can do anything you want about it.
Yeah, so cool.
This interview could easily be like several hours because there's so many things that you both have just talked about that I would talk about forever. One of my favorite things that I'm so passionate about with game development is, I've said this like on multiple interviews too with other people. When you look at the history of video game development, there's sections of it. Some people, like when you look at comic books or movies, they talk about like the Silver Age or the Golden Age. And so video games have like the indie apocalypse that happened in like the early 2010s or the late 2000s, the Steam era, whenever there was only like 7 games a year releasing on Steam. And what's so interesting to me about game development is that there was this period from the early 2000s to the late 2000s that I would call the Wild West of video game development, maybe even the early or the late 90s, I suppose. because of the introduction of the internet, there was, well, first of all, even before the internet, there was things like when I hear stories like Bungie developing Halo, Marty O'Donnell, the composer, talks about going in on his first day in the studio and being thrown back because all of the developers inside of Bungie were like just out of college frat guys trying to develop this game for the Mac before being purchased by Microsoft. And all of them, they had this mindset like, dude, this is so awesome, and like high-fiving each other, and they had pizza everywhere, and he said it looked dirty in the inside, like there was just pizza boxes and trash bags everywhere. And he was this like 40-year-old guy who had already had a career in advertising, and he's like, look at this. And so to expound on that, right, when you get into the era of the internet, you, exactly what you and Adam were just talking about, flash games, places like Newgrounds and so many different internet forums. And what blows my mind about that is I've plugged this podcast a few other times, but there's a podcast called hosted by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. And every Monday they release a new episode, and it's real game developers interviewing real game developers. So Insomniac's former president, Ted Price, I think I said all that correctly, he'll interview other game directors and things like that in AAA studios. The part about it I love is that they all talk about their histories of working in video games, and a lot like what you're talking about, Thomas, there's this time period where so many of them just met on Newgrounds, or they met from these internet forums. Like Gareth Coker, my favorite video game composer right now, he was discovered by Moon Studios on an internet forum randomly, and then he got to do the music for Ori and then the Will of the Wisps. And then now he just recently did the music for Halo Infinite back in like 2022. I mean, that's a career absolutely just coming from an internet forum. C418 was found by Marcus Pearson for Minecraft on an internet forum. It's just like that stuff blows my mind. And so I know you found a collaborator online to help you develop the mobile port of Kingdom initially. I'm not sure if you also met your composer Amos Roddy in the same way, but it just blows my mind because... That stuff is so fascinating to me.
I think Amos sent me an email just applying, like, hey, I played the Flash game. Or was it after I announced? I guess after I announced I was working on like a bigger version of the Kingdom game, maybe even on Twitter or something, that he approached me and was like, hey. I think that's still a valid way of, you know, doing things. Honestly, I found collaborators on Twitter, you know, up till recently. I think just reaching out to somebody and saying like, hey, I like what you're doing. Is there a way of working together? That's great. I mean, the industry is huge now. That means that there is more competition, but it also means that there are more opportunities. And what you say about this, like the Silver Age or something, I think I've been lucky enough to just release Kingdom on like the tail end of that. I felt like when I released Kingdom, there was definitely this idea of like, you knew all the indie game devs that existed at the time. Like you would have met a significant portion of them and like talked to them. And that was also really useful because there was a lot of inside information and not as much. There was more like the kind of feeling that this inside information was really valuable. And right, and nowadays it's more like there's also a lot of fear, like, will my game work? Will it get enough attention? And you know, the competition is so stiff that sometimes the focus nowadays can be on how do I survive in the current industry rather than, hey, look, I found this cool trick to make water reflections in Flash. Do you want the code for it?
So another really interesting thing about all of that, like you and Adam were talking about the Flash games. They like to jokingly refer to me as like the 12 or 13-year-old on the podcast because I'm the youngest member. So whenever they reference the older strategy games, even the ones that you've talked about, like Z or Z or like the first Red Alert games that you said you played, it's stuff that's like just before my time, or at least I wasn't into strategy games at the time, things like that. So they like to say that stuff. But funnily enough, for this interview, I played Seed, which was your Flash game. And I swear I've actually experienced that game before. I don't know if I saw it in like a YouTube compilation in 2006 or something, or if it was something I actually played on Newgrounds at the time when I was much younger. But I swear I've seen that game before. And it sparked something in me because I think all of your games, for the most part, maybe not every single one of them, but most of them have something to do with foliage. You have a very clear, like, you're clearly very passionate about dynamically evolving plants and foliage.
It's true. I hadn't framed it like that to myself as much, but sometimes I have this realization. I'm like, oh, I'm just doing the same thing over and over again. I'm still doing plants in some way. Yeah. And I also, I mean, I love the way, I love the aesthetic of foliage, of like greenery, of overgrown things. And I think that's been a recurring theme. Also, Kingdom was kind of like, it's a strategy game, but it's also an excuse for you to be in this overgrown forest island world to experience that. And sometimes now I'm kind of getting maybe mature enough to think about like, well, if that's the message that I want to transfer, then what's the best game to do that in, rather than just naively making a game because I, you know, a game needs these and these things. So now I put them together. But on the other hand, like Kingdom was quite a naive undertaking and it worked out great. So maybe the naivety is also good in a way, and you should just do whatever comes to mind first and make plants and put a king in it and soldiers in.
I actually think that's a funny point, because I think looking at your games, of the ones that include foliage or any aesthetic choice like that, Kingdom is probably the only one that incentivizes the player to like destroy the forest and tear it down. Because even playing it today, there's always the thing about when you're self-exploring for the first time, you're trying to figure out, how does the game determine which trees I can mark to chop down? Like, is it just progressive to how far I get for the tree? Is it only the closest tree to the kingdom? And then there's a limit of like 5. And then eventually you discover that like there's just random patches of the forest that you can interact with in that way to chop down. And so it has something to do with it has something very specifically to do with the amount of trees grouped together. Like you have to start to whittle them away before you can get rid of all of them. And then you also have to wait for the bushes to disappear and the background to disappear before you can even expand your kingdom. And so it's funny that you mentioned that, because it's like the only one of your games I can think of that incentivizes destroying nature.
Yeah. And I mean, it's because I was just following tropes of games, right? It's like Warcraft 3, you can cut down the trees. So that's what you do. There's trees, you cut them down. I wasn't even thinking about what message does that have or how does it relate to that message. Or, you know, it's just like, if there's trees, you got to be able to cut them down, and that gives you resources. And I think that's good also. Like all of Kingdom was kind of designed that way, just kind of almost on autopilot. Like, oh, it's an archer, so he's got to shoot. Oh, it's a knight, so he has a shield. And like kind of it all just flowed from what everything seemed obvious in a way. And that's why you get this thing where it's like, oh, you can cut down the trees. And if you think about it, it's like, is that right? Like, should you be able to cut down the trees? Because then the island is like empty and barren or whatever. But yeah, I think it's also it's a good game all in all. And people have had this thought of like, do I want to cut down the trees? It's kind of a shame because they look good. So actually it kind of maybe brings across a message even stronger than if you would not be able to cut them down.
Yeah, I remember working really hard the further I got to like, once I had noticed the things I could build in the kingdom, I eventually got to a point where I was trying to like prioritize chopping down trees further away. That way I could build walls and keep the trees in my kingdom. And I think I've heard you mention like not expecting players to do that in the past or not thinking about it in that way. But I really want to jump into this third point, because going all the way back to when we were talking about the terminology I used, like aesthetic strategy, you asked, I don't know if games can still accomplish this or if there's a market for that or necessarily like how popular that might be. I think the two major things there is that, one, I think from my perspective, almost all of the games that you've made, I would consider aesthetic strategy for very particular reasons. And I think secondly, we're seeing an evolution of that where they're not allowed to be as minimalist as the games that you've made in the past. When I think of aesthetic strategy in a way, they're not necessarily strategy games at their core, but it's kind of games like Dredge or, I mean, I know you've mentioned Sable when talking about Garbage Country. And so those games aren't necessarily strategy, but there are plenty of games like them, like Cloud Gardens is a simulation game where they still provide the strategy mechanics, but they have to complicate the game in the sandbox in order to draw players in. Because I think you're right. Players do want, they want more engagement. They want more content out of their product, but they still want to interact with it in a way where the aesthetic has been prioritized. And I think that's what makes Kingdom initially so successful and what makes it so long lasting, is that you prioritize the aesthetic. It actually started out as a pixel art project, and then it becoming a strategy game with advanced mechanics Like, you prioritize the water reflections. I mean, that was the first impression I got from that game, was the way the forest looked in the water reflections. It was the aesthetic of the going back and forth, like the side-scrolling for a strategy game, not the premise or the description on Steam. And so prioritizing the aesthetic there, I think you've done that in all of your games, right? Like, even looking at Garbage Country, it's a game where you're exploring this overworld apocalyptic environment. But what appeals to me about it is the visual clarity of it, the design of the like the aesthetic visuals of the art style, the 3D pixel artwork, those things. And every time I look at Garbage Country and I think of what the game could have when I see different UI elements, or I see another image from you of like what a menu looks like, or a mechanic like interacting with the radio towers, I think about the game and I want it to be huge. Like, I want it to have as many mechanics as something like Spiritfarer or Dredge, where there's like a million menus for me to interact with. But then I have to bring myself back down and I'm like, no, I'm going to like Garbage Country when it comes out, because even if it's just driving, it'll be like, it will still have looked very good, have immersed me in that way, and I'll still have appreciated like the journey I took to the end of the game.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting what you said in terms of like prioritizing the aesthetic. And I think that's something, like, regardless of my doubts of like can a game like this work, it's definitely something I'm still doing, and I have done with every game. It's like the kind of the vibe of it is the most important, and the game mechanics are allowed to have a lower priority. If you have to choose between the vibes and the game mechanics, then you choose the vibes. And I'm still applying that very heavily also for Garbage Country. But on the other hand, I also feel this pressure, and the thing you just mentioned about like, oh, you want it to have menus and mechanics and depth and a lot of stuff. I feel that. So I'm putting all these things in the game, and I'm often kind of regretting it because I'm thinking, wow, this is a lot of work. Like, if you have mechanics and you want to have overlapping mechanics, then, you know, it's like exponential the amount of work you have to do to tie it all together. And then I kind of regret it, but I'm kind of happy from this conversation guessing like, well, maybe I'm somewhere in a happy middle, you know, like the aesthetic still has priority, and I'm putting a lot of effort in these mechanics because it's also what players want. And maybe that wherever you end up is a happy marriage of those two things, hopefully. Though the grass is always greener. In my mind, I'm always like, I could have done the just driving version of the game that you just mentioned, where you're just driving in a beautiful world, and I would have been done by now, and I would not have had as much pressure as I do now. But that's another world that's... We'll never know.
Yeah, you see, when we talk about aesthetics, one thing that we even talked about it with Jack in one of our previous episodes is that like the games are coming out right now, like lots of them has this, I would say, not basic, but like really not thought out UI in terms of like UI is completely distinguished from the games. What I noticed, for example, in Kingdom and in the game right now, which you are developing, is that basically UI and UX experience is directly connected to the game. Yes, so you can see on the car like the status of what's his equipment, I guess. That is a thing that's in today's world is kind of omitted. Like, for example, newest RTS games have the UI that basically for me looks like copy paste from each other games. So you get less simple boxes with the name. Okay, you have 20 units of that, 30 units of this, and stuff like that. And when it comes to getting you immersed into the games and to feel atmosphere, you need to make UI at least match the graphics. And you put it on the other extent of the spectrum because you basically make a UI graphic in terms of, I don't know, like, I remember the bag of coins in Kingdom. That was crazy satisfying because, like, you could feel this coin is, like, you know, falling into this bag. Like, this is the coin, not some plus three value. Okay, when you played, like, 20 years of this game, at some point you felt, okay, I know it, let's keep it. But, like, in the beginning, like, this feeling of ka-ching sound, like, it made it worth. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think this game developers often refer to this as diegetic design, which is like doing things in the world rather than in a UI layer. It's just a lot of work. And I think for a lot of game developers, it's kind of like the holy grail, you know, they want to do everything in the world. I don't think any game designer will tell you like, no, I don't like it. But it's just a lot of work, and it's limited because you know, this coin bag has a limited space, or if you want to do a backpack where the things are actually 3D objects in a backpack, you have limited space. Like in most games, characters can carry an inhuman amount of stuff that you could never represent on the character physically. But I do enjoy it as well. I think mostly I want to just take away layers of abstraction that kind of take you out of the game. Like you said, I think it's more, you can stay more immersed, just kind of like if you have to press fewer buttons and if things kind of like naturally flow and you never have this moment of like, oh, you see something in your inventory, but like, how does it relate to your character or your stats? You kind of like see it instantly and it lets you get on with the game. It's just about removing friction for me. There's also games that do it like very over the top and very cool. And as a showy thing, I can't recall the name, but there was this other game where the character opens their backpack and it's this like leather strap that folds open and all the equipment is like 3D object, and then they roll it up again and it's like, wow, that's showy. Like now you're just showing off. I'm not looking for that level of showing off. I'm mostly just looking for removing friction. Same in Kingdom. I think if you would pop up a dialogue that asks you which building to build, that's a moment where you as a player are going to think, wait, what does this mean? What are these three buildings? What are the consequences? Whereas in the current design of Kingdom, if you put a coin somewhere, it's already done. You're not like taken out of the game to think about this choice. You put the coin, the building starts building, and you've kind of made the decision. You're free to go do other stuff. You're not like taken out of the world. And I think that's kind of what appeals about it to me.
Yeah, it also makes the gameplay satisfying, because except for the, you know, pure mechanic of getting, you know, like your base bigger and building the boat and so on, like at some point, like let's call it like minute to minute gameplay is about the sound. This, you can feel the archers are striking the foes, like this meat that you get out of the gameplay. This is the thing that when you die, like separate the ray. And I know what you understand, what you are talking about the games. That is for games, it's really hard to develop such UI. And the game you mentioned probably is Sons of the Forest, because I played it, and then you had a backpack, you put everything out, and this was crazy inconvenient to play. On the other hand, the feeling of you having a backpack, to look at each side of it, to look what's held in each part of it, like it, each time I opened, I was like, man, I have so much stuff. And when you have the number, you don't feel this down to the ground feeling of like, you know, like being there. That's what you said again, to like being into the game. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned before, like, that strategy games kind of by necessity, I guess, are forced to introduce like a big abstraction layer, you know, like you have units, they have health, they have stats. Ironically, I think because everybody has to start from scratch with strategy games, they end up kind of like, you know, you do a lot of effort to get like pathfinding, targeting, like all that stuff in. And then you kind of end up at this thing where you're like, okay, now we have a strategy game and it's kind of similar to other games. If we had still something with the power of the Warcraft 3 level editor, we might see more variation, because then people coming in with more creativity, and the strategy part is kind of already done. The pathfinding is there. Pathfinding is so hard in strategy games. Like if you're just starting out in Unity, there's no way you're going to get something nearly as smooth as like Warcraft 3 or Starcraft, you know? So then we might have like more creativity on that front. But I would also really like it. I would love to see more hybrid strategy like games with more immersive UIs that are gamepad compatible, because I don't always want to like hack and slash RPG my way through something. I just want to watch other little guys do it, but I do want to sit on the couch and I do want to be immersed. I don't want to look at numbers and stats and stuff.
Yeah, you talked about Warcraft 3. Warcraft 3 has this, again, like, let's call it a separate UI. On the other hand, the aesthetics, icons, the look of it is, it's really, like, you can feel, it's not separate from the game itself. Like, when you see the icons of some attack, you can directly visualize how it will look like, because it's so, like, the whole graphics, even in World of Warcraft, basically they did exactly the same, yes? They made a UI that looks in the same way as a game itself. On the other hand, when it comes to strategy games, I talked about Heroes of Might and Magic Olden Era, and there, for example, there is a spell book, and unfortunately, due to it being so good looking, I couldn't find a thing in it. And this is also scary, yes? You make the great design, it looks beautiful, and you basically don't know what to look at when you are simply playing the game.
Yeah. And that's really hard to find the line there of like, you know, making everything look good, but also making it functional. And then you just have to decide, like, do you choose functional or do you choose good looking? And if you want to choose the aesthetics, you might have to give in on functionality.
So I know in your Thomas Brush interview, he asked you questions like developer to developer about building minimum viable products as a game. And your like the design approach that developers take between either focusing on a concept, because like verbatim from what you were talking about, game design school is all about like taking the core mechanic or loop and then exercising that as much as possible until you have like a refined, focused game. Or at the very least, when you expand on that, it's still developed in mind as a product. So I know he asked you those questions in mind because he wanted to know your approach, because, you know, in response, you were basically saying, well, I feel like my games aren't very focused. I start with an idea, I might toss that idea, and then it might become something else, like using the foliage mechanics from your original Garbage Country demo for Cloud Gardens. But when you actually look at those things, right, like it raises a few questions to me, because I guess one of the first things I'd ask, like, having removed yourself from Kingdom now, with that being such a successful product by itself so early on for your game development career and giving you the platform to develop games in the future, do you kind of feel like, especially as you develop creative ideas and then just come up with things and want to see them become a game more than a product, do you feel like you have to escape Kingdom a little bit? I mean, it's kind of a long way to ask, like, do you feel like you're trying to, I guess, prove yourself beyond Kingdom? But I think it's more nuanced than that.
Definitely. You know, I was quite lucky with Kingdom's reception, but not like never have to work again lucky. So I still making games and I still quite enjoy doing it. I think it's also been good because you do see if you the those stellar indie successes, there are some cases where there isn't really a second game, because how do you live up to that? Plus, like, you don't have the financial pressure. And I think financial pressure, as tough as it may feel at times, does really help you, like, push on. You know, you have this thing where you're like, well, I have to launch this game, like, I have to ship it, because, you know, and in terms of living up to Kingdom, or kind of, I mean, as immediately after I was done with Kingdom, I had worked on little pixel art Knights and Archers for 8 years at that point, and I was kind of done with that. I wanted to, like, spread my wings and do something different. So that's why also I that was also one of the reasons why I sold Kingdom to Raw Fury. And I said, you know, I'm going to do different things. But with that, I also put a lot of pressure on myself to then actually make different things. So then I wanted to make maybe a non-violent game, like try not a game about shooting for once, which then took a long time for that to become Cloud Gardens. And there were definitely moments there where, you know, you just kind of like wonder, where is it going? What am I doing? And especially if you don't self-impose deadlines and if you don't have a process, I think if you have a clear process in terms of 1 month prototype, 1 month something, something, so many months production, then you have something to hold on to. But if you don't have a process, you can noodle for a year and a half and all sorts of insecurities could come up. So yeah, it's something that is always there. But all in all, in a good way, I think I really liked that I wanted to do something non-violent and then, you know, kind of succeeded at that. And now I'm kind of okay making a game where there's a bit of shooty again. I'm also now looking back at Kingdom in a more critical way, or at least more examining, like, what made Kingdom such a good game, especially since I'm now making a tower defense game. Kingdom is also to some degree a tower defense game. I'm like, what made Kingdom work so well? And then you can see, then now I'm really examining those design choices of like, yeah, the UI is super simple. That's those reasons why it works. I didn't really realize them back then, but now I can kind of look back at it and see what I can take from there in a good way.
Yeah, because the, like, when I look at your history of games, the business side of me sees something like Kingdom success. And if I was in your shoes, what is the next game I would do to spread my wings and try to prove myself? And like the business side of me is like, well, I wouldn't make Kingdom, but I would need like the big shooty thing, you know, like I wouldn't have made Cloud Gardens. But then the creative side of me, right, is like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like I wouldn't have progressed to Pizza Possum, but that's only because in my mind it's like, you know, you have this platform and then you're trying to prove yourself, so you try to like you try to check the financial statements here and then make sure you make like the most profitably, like the most potentially profitable game. But the creative side of me is like, I would have wanted to make Cloud Gardens. I would have wanted something that still felt like a very clear product with, even if it wasn't focused in development, it has a clear purpose. You build these dioramas in the way that you do. And that, you know, like that speaks to the creative aspect of me. Like if I had worked on Kingdom for that long, I probably would have made Cloud Gardens. And then you clearly have been trying to implement multiplayer into your games for a very long time, from like the earliest demo of Garbage Country. And so Pizza Possum seemed to be like the breakthrough of that. And then I know you probably looked at it again with Garbage Country again. And, you know, now here we are with like this single player experience. So it seems like in the future, you're probably going to produce another multiplayer game. I imagine that seems to be something that you care about.
I definitely think it's just fascinating. Multiplayer is such a cheat code for fun. Like if you put two players in an empty world and there's like a box to play with, they will have fun. You know, they will toss the box around or whatever. And you're seeing this now with this, like, you know, derogatorily friend slop genre. Like you just put four players in a world with some junk to play with and it's great and it's fun and they can voice chat. Like I think it's just really a fun thing. Developing for multiplayer is a bit tricky because like it doesn't work if you don't have another player, and game development can be like a very like a flow state where you're just like, you know, you're in the game, you're programming. If you then do not have that multiplayer component there to test, it can kind of take you out of the flow, whereas developing a single player game, you can stay in that flow because you're constantly like playing it yourself. So I think development is a bit harder, and I also felt that with like the first prototype that I was calling Garbage Country back then. And Pizza Possum was an example actually of putting the process first. Like me and Friedemann, a friend of mine here in Berlin, we said, let's make a game together and let's have a fixed process where it is like 1 week or 2 weeks prototype, so many months production. And we banked that game out in I think 6, 7, 8 months or something like that. And the process was like very pleasant, no anxieties at all, because you know where it's going to end, you know where it's going. It's just a compact development, but it doesn't allow you to go as deep. It doesn't allow you to go back on choices, to put extra stuff in, to throw stuff out. And with my other games, that's something that's happening a lot. Like you can go really deep, and if you feel the game needs something, then you can just take a week and add that thing, at the peril of one more week of expenses having to be paid.
Yeah, so getting back to finances, I'm just wondering, because I looked at the history of your games and I noticed that it was ported to Nvidia Shield. And how did it happen? Like, you know, we have iOS, we have Nintendo Switch, so we have like a base consoles, like players, and then you get a port for Nvidia Shield. How does it look like? I'm just curious.
I think with a lot of those newer consoles, there is this initial period where the developer is also paying for you to port things, right? Because they want a bigger catalog on those platforms. So if I think it was probably under Raw Fury already, I don't think I negotiated that deal. And if they have a deal, if they have something where they can make use of, then they will do that. The game was also on Apple TV, actually, Kingdom, which was a really fun thing to make a game for, because Apple TV, I don't know if it's still the same or even still exists, it had this remote control with a little touchpad. And you could then swipe on the little touchpad. You're like flicking the coins in the game. You can get really fun little interactions. And to make the so you can sprint in Kingdom. On PC, it's just double tap in a direction. But on tvOS, you actually crack the remote like a whip to make the horse go faster. So it was actually one of the more fun ports that we did. And I think, you know, that game is out on everything because it just runs so light. It's a port of a Flash game originally. It doesn't need anything. And that's kind of nice.
I remember the times when they were like, you know, this journalist saying that Apple TV is the next console. It'll be huge, yeah, in the gaming world. So I guess, you know, some developers hop on the train, and unfortunately this train ended up on the first station, I guess.
Yeah, though I did demo the game on Apple TV because it was an easy device to bring somewhere as well. So it wasn't, I have good memories of it. I think it might also be the motivation that maybe Apple will give you better featuring if you put it on all of their platforms. You know, there's always different motivations to put games on different platforms, like also Nvidia Shield. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I guess there was also Borderlands on, I don't know, like five more games on this platform. So Your kingdom is one of them. Like, cool. It's a thing to be proud of.
I think so. Oh, actually, now that we had a conversation with an airline for us to put it on their in-flight entertainment system as well. Never happened.
Man, I would love it. Because there's Angry Birds when you fly the plane, and the kingdom is such a good game to play on a plane.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would love it. And you can do it with one finger. So why not?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I think it should be on the airline, the same reasons that Adam suggested. But I think like that, the turnoff of that to me is that Kingdom is not a game that you can beat in one sitting. I don't think New Lands is that way, especially with the amount of content. And the appeal to it is that even if it's still minimalist and seems smaller or runs lightly or has like a very small download size, you come back to it and you sit down multiple times. Or like when I was in college playing Kingdom 2 Crowns with a friend, I was like, granted, there's just a little bit more padding in the overall gameplay loop, but like we were sitting there for days staying up late, like trying to figure out what does what, how to make the walls turn into stone, things like that. And so it was like, that's the appeal of it. I don't think it's something like, even on the phone, I don't get on my phone enough as to play a game like that to justify playing it there. Like I need the controller in my hands to sit down and like come back to the same save multiple times.
Absolutely, the medium that you play something on also really affects the experience that you have. Like, you know, from sitting on the couch with a gamepad or sitting at your PC on a desk, on a proper desk chair, or playing it on your mobile, they all kind of like suggest maybe a different game loop, and the game has to work for that environment. And I think phones used to be more of a gamer thing where you really dive in, and now phones is more like a quick fix, do something for 5 minutes before you do something else. So I'm really glad that we still have consoles and PC, that we still have channels for like deep experiences where you really can get into something and you know, lose track of time and feel immersed.
Yeah, I meant to actually ask you this way earlier in the interview, but are you able to detach yourself and enjoy your own games? Like, are you able to go play Kingdom Classic or New Lands and appreciate, like, not that you made the water texture reflections, but that like you can sit there and play the game, or is it all just code and examination for you?
I think I'm very detail-oriented. So also while developing the game, I take a lot of joy in you know, like how the coin bounces. And I will do this hundreds of times, and I will just be playing the game, focus on those things, going through all the little interactions. In Kingdom, I remember so often playing through much more of a session than I needed to test some bug, because I was just like, oh, this is nice. And oh, when the trees are cut, like, how is the animation when they fall down? Oh, that feels nice. And just going like from one thing to the other, kind of like playing it on a very like experiential level or something. And I do the same with the game currently. Sometimes I'll just be like doing donuts in the car for 20 minutes, even though I was working on something else. I don't know if I play them through like I know the story, I know where it goes, so I don't get that novelty. And for me, a very important motivation in games is like novelty. Like RTS games also, like I want to see what the next building is, I want to see what the next unit is, I want to see, do they get even stronger and crazier? And that stuff, of course, like I know that by heart for Kingdom. I know exactly where it goes, so I don't really get that satisfaction of it. But I do get the low-level satisfaction of just the visuals and the interactions and how it all feels.
I guess the next obvious question is that, are you still playing Kingdom 2 Crowns with the new DLCs, or have you stopped?
I haven't played it in a while. I played it a while back because Raw Fury was doing this 10-year anniversary thing. But it's been a while since I actually played it, yeah.
As we get towards the end here, to go back to, we were talking about like the appeal of multiplayer, but also the appeal of games like this. I think, and I mean, granted, I'm no successful game developer, but from a player perspective and from a game development perspective for what I've done, it feels like the reason the derogatory term friend slop appeals to so many people is because of the sandbox elements, right? It's what makes Kingdom go up a notch, which is the physically rendered coins in the bag, or at least the animation that becomes like a physically rendered coin. And so it's that as a sandbox mechanic. It's the... like the sandbox in general could just easily be described as like the knights, the trees, any of the mechanics interacting. But it's also the things that are, even if there's only like so many simulations of the coin falling, like there's only so many preset animations that could happen. I'm not sure exactly how that system works, but even if that was the case, it's still random enough and could happen at any given moment where you're just running out of stamina on the horse, and then the farmer just decides to drop enough gold to crush you. And so then you're dropping all of it in the ocean. So it's like those things are sandbox elements. It's what makes games like Mage Arena or Yap Yap, where you use your voice to cast spells, interesting. It's the sandbox of like the introduced mechanics. And so that's what I would think. And so what appeals to me about something like Garbage Country versus something like Cloud Gardens is that there's an interaction with core gameplay mechanics with driving the car. There's probably, especially with the tower defense, things that you might not be able to plan. Like there has to be an aspect of chaos that interacts with the sandbox elements that makes the game appealing. And I think even as a developer, that would probably make you appreciate playing it more and experiencing things you just can't after 1,000 attempts, like something you could not experience if you wanted to, unless it just happened.
100%. I think you exactly nailed it. And it's also something I really look for while designing games, is having mechanics that also surprise myself, that are not deterministic. They don't always turn out the same way. There's always something that can go a little bit different and the game surprises you and you don't know exactly how it's going to go. And having these overlapping simulations that kind of lead to that. And I think in an RTS game, little guys running across the battlefield is one of those things, because you don't really know, are they going to run fast enough? Are they going to make it? Are they going to get hit? And that kind of gives you this unpredictability. Physics-based games like driving, you know, there's a bit of that unpredictability, like how does the car drive? How will it react to hills, bumps, turns, whatever? And with those friend games, with multiplayer games, of course, your friends are unpredictable. And if you add physics into that mix, like friends games with physics, it's brilliant. And it's also such an efficient way to make a game, because the physics engine is just doing that for you. You hook up multiplayer. Also, multiplayer is not as hard as it used to be. Like it used to be, you needed a network programmer. I think nowadays you can get away with, you know, some decent programming knowledge, but not as hardcore as back in the day. And then you just got a fun sandbox, like you said. Yeah.
As we are nearing the end, I have a question, because I'm always curious. What have you been playing recently?
I'm really looking to get like into something where I really feel this gets me. And I feel like sometimes at the end of the day, I'm also tired. I'm a bit lazy. I just want to like not think too much. I love games like Factorio, but that's just like programming with graphics. Like I can't after an entire day of programming. I've been playing I played Sword of the Sea, just very chill, aesthetic, beautiful. I started playing The Ascent. It's this like twin stick shooter that's just like zero brain, just shoot stuff. It's kind of like nice. Unreal Engine looks great. Like it's just, you know, kind of superficial. I played some of these like Golden Idol, and I'm playing The Root Trees Are Dead right now, and I'm playing Immortality, so some of those deduction games.
It has like four layers of deepness, I guess, because you basically discovering the story, and there's the story behind the story behind the story in this.
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking forward to that. Like you can sense the layers already, because it's like it's a movie, but it's about movies, so you can kind of sense that they might go a couple levels deeper.
Still, they are doing like because I finished it, I was like, yeah, but what is the story? It's like, you know, what are the maybe some story nitpicks that I didn't catch? And when I looked online, the story is so amazingly deep. Like, oh my god, like what happened there? So maybe you should discover it yourself.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting to a point where I can allow myself to look online, to feel like, okay, I've discovered enough by myself that I can go and like get the spoilers. Yeah,
you. I believe you won't discover everything. Like for me, I was like, yeah, I got everything, and then I looked at it and I was like, oh my god, okay, I didn't get a thing.
Very cool.
And I played this game.
Yeah. Oh, and another game that I was playing is Baby Steps, and I really am not like, I don't like those kind of rage games. I'm not somebody who tries over and over, but the beautiful thing about Baby Steps is it tricked me into it. It just slowly crept up on me. And that's something I also really hope to do with my games, is like trick people into depth. Like if you're not like, oh, I don't want to deal with this, like, oh, units and damage and I don't want to build walls. But in Kingdom, you're kind of like tricked into it. You're just like, yeah, but it's just a horse. Just walk around, see what happens. And it's the same for Baby Steps. It's like, you know that maybe it's that kind of game, but in the beginning, it's just like, yeah, just walk around, see what happens. And before you know it, you're trying to go up the fucking mountain and like, you know, doing this to yourself. And I thought that was really cool.
The guy who developed the game has really similar story to yours, because he developed this QWOP game when you simply had to walk down the trail. And, yeah. You know, 20 Resetter.
Yeah, it's Bennett and also Gabe who did Ape Out before. And we met sometimes and we chatted also about Baby Steps also. But it's also one of the things I really enjoyed playing. I guess I've been playing a little bit more the last year compared to the years before. Just trying to find those kind of chill experiences. But if you have a recommendation, I would love something like a chill RTS-like experience that I can play on a gamepad. Kind of like Pikmin, maybe. Like, I'm really looking for something like that.
We'll DM you. We'll get the hosts together and figure out. Because Tim, he's not on this episode, but he's usually the one that recommends like the chill RTS games. It's like his break because he's a game designer on Beyond All Reason. But it's he's usually better at those suggestions. But as we get towards the end, don't want to drag on too much longer for both of you, but I did say I would talk about this selfishly. Amos Roddy, I'm a huge fan of his work, and to me, as somebody who loves video game soundtracks, you know, just very briefly, to me, a video game soundtrack has to be its own product, separate from the game, that can live beyond the game and enhance the experience of the game. And the reason why his soundtrack for Kingdom and Kingdom Two Crowns appeals to me so much is because I like and really appreciate the game that Kingdom is itself. So like, if that wasn't the case, it doesn't make the soundtrack worse, because I like soundtracks to games I just don't like. But I think whenever both of those things appeal to me so heavily and collaborate so well as pieces of art, it's like it enhances each other. So to me, it's like, you know, what was it like not only just breaking out into the industry with Kingdom, but also having somebody pull off basically building a separate product from your game that has to also enhance the experience? Because that's like, I don't get to talk to developers about that very much.
Yeah. Working with Amos was a dream. He reached out to me and said, hey, do you need some music for your game? And I think he already sent one demo along that he made either specifically for that or something that he thought would fit. And even that demo that he sent along was just, in my eyes, an instant hit. I was like, wow, this is beautiful. This is nostalgic, melancholy. It just hits, you know, kind of all the notes that I wanted to hit with Kingdom. And working with him was also, it was a no notes type situation. He would just send over tracks. And it was actually more like the opposite. Rather than me looking for a specific type of music for a scene in the game, it was me configuring the game to fit to certain bits of music. So like, he would send me a track and it would sound like a rainy morning. So then I would build a rainy morning for Kingdom around this whenever this track plays. And what is also really, what I really like and what I've always applied since then is just have these, because you said it's like a standalone product, the soundtrack, or it's like, you know, it can stand on its own. Also treating the tracks as such. Because a lot of games write looped music where it's like, oh, you need a loop and then you need a higher intensity loop for when the battle starts and then you have like a lower intensity loop again. But that kind of like pulls apart the music in a way. I guess it's necessary for games to do that, but I'm not a fan of it. I love just being able to put a 3-minute track into the game and play it start to finish uninterrupted and then maybe have a bit of quiet and then maybe you play another track. And that's what we were able to do with Kingdom. That's what we were able to do with Cloud Garden Sandbox OST. And I'm talking to Amos now to see if he has time to work with me for Garbage Country as well.
I know, because he's so busy with Minecraft, isn't he?
He did the Minecraft thing. He's busy with some other things. I'm not entirely sure if it will work out. He did do some experimentations that already sound really good, so I would really love to have his music. And also listening, you know, you said before, like, do you ever think back of Kingdom or like, well, how is it working like after something like that? Listening to the soundtrack specifically also for me has like an emotional impact where I was like, you know, this nostalgia of like, oh yeah, I remember back when I was making Kingdom, that was a good game. There was a lot of feelings there. And the soundtrack still has that for me. Yeah, it's great.
Well, that is like music to my ears because, I don't know, I'm so passionate about that stuff. But Thomas, thank you so much for joining us. I hope we were able to entertain you with conversations about strategy games and force you to talk about your own work history. But thanks so much for agreeing to come on with us.
Gladly. Thank you. It was really interesting. I hope I've been able to interest the listeners as well. And Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Just wanted to say also, if anybody listening to the podcast wants to reach out, ask me any questions, you can find me online and I'm pretty easy to reach. So feel free to like shoot over anything you might want to ask or know. Yeah, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Thomas is like this in every interview, everybody. Every interview I've watched of him, everybody's like, you're so down to earth and just having a conversation. But anyways, it's a pleasure to have you on. I know Adam and I were both excited to talk about this. And whenever I discovered the game through Kingdom Two Crowns, I was like, you know, I had no knowledge of the separation of you between like you as a developer and Raw Fury or anything. So my impressions were for the series itself. It wasn't for a particular game. And so that stuck with me as I did my research backwards years ago. But that is to say, thank you for joining us, Adam. It was also great having you help me host today.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Thomas, for interview. It was really interesting. To be honest, like it's a pleasure to meet someone that created one of the games that made me to get by in my studies years. So, you know, I get my master's thanks to you, I guess.
So for further context for everybody, this year marks the 10-year anniversary of the Kingdom series as a whole from its initial release. I know Raw Fury, the publisher, and now, you know, Kingdom holder, they've done a 10-year celebration this year that Thomas has done some content for, about an hour-long podcast, and I know he's probably interacted with their community in the game a little bit more during that time. So for anybody who's interested in the game or is getting into the series because of this or loves the series, 10-year anniversary happened this year, tons of updates, sales have been going on, things like that. We've timed this podcast specifically so it will go live shortly after the Humble Bundle for Kingdom ends, so everybody will have to pay full price for the game and support the studio. Not really, but that's just the way it worked out. So for anybody who is interested, though, Kingdom Classic, I believe, is permanently free on Steam, so that's always an entry point. And the upgrade to New Lands is only a couple of bucks more. And then, obviously, from that point on, the rest of the series goes for Raw Fury. But please, everybody, go check out Thomas Vandenberg's other titles, Odd Gardens, Pizza Possum, now Garbage Country releasing next year. And Thomas, do you have anywhere that you want to direct listeners to go or let them know anything about Garbage Country?
That's a good question. I guess thomasvandenberg.com, and then there will be a link to Garbage Country. Garbage Country is also on Steam. And also, if you have played Kingdom, I'm hoping that Garbage Country will be a game that kind of revives a lot of the philosophies of that game. So I hope that it can appeal to a similar audience.
All right. And then so for everyone listening to Critical Moves, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode. Critical Moves can be found at criticalmovespodcast.com. We have our YouTube channels. We're available on basically any streaming platform that you can listen to a podcast on. So if this is your first episode, go check out the website where you can get a part of a forum. You can join our community Discord, where a lot of these game developers usually are. And you can come chat with us. Let us know what topics you want to talk about, what things you want to hear about, and any games that you'd like to have covered. So everyone, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Critical Moves, and we'll catch you next time.